So what was the essence of the first prayer offered to Narayan Rishi by Markandeya Rishi? When one Rishi offers prayers to another Rishi, and these two are on, of course, not on the same level, but Markandeya Rishi was a powerful ascetic, incredibly powerful ascetic, who had, practically speaking, almost perfected controlling his mind. And it's interesting to contrast between his reaction to when what Huendra sent to disturb his mind and the reaction of Tekua Haridas. Tekua Haridas is the most powerful. His mind didn't waver even in at its core, even in the slightest amount, because of the depth of his surrender and attachment to the holy names and to Krishna. No false ego whatsoever. So, what was the essence of that prayer? That first prayer? Okay. What book were we reading? We'll start there again. And it wasn't the Ananda Vrindavan Champu.
Krishna is all powerful and all merciful, so we should worship him.
Okay. What was the first part?
Krishna is all powerful.
No.
Did Krishna give the power to describe about him?
That is his gift. He gives the, for anyone to speak, that energy is coming from Krishna. So how could the energy know the energetic completely and sufficiently to be able to, in this case, glorify him fully and properly? But yet, although Krishna is so powerful, he also so kindly and mercifully comes as to reciprocate with those who worship him by being their bhava bandhu, their dear friend. That's, of course, the benefit of giving the class as opposed to hearing the class, is that it's easier to remember the glorious words of the great sage Markandeya Rishi. So that was text 40. And 41, continuing his prayers, remember he's a perfected Rishi. Why do we say he's perfected? Because he's so powerful that he's able to see. Lord Narayan Rishi was so pleased with him that he came to him, and that is the way to be able to see God, the Supreme Lord, as Srila Prabhupada said, quoting Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, don't try and see God, try to act in such a way that the Lord will see you, want to see you. Then it's easy to see him when he wants to see you. So because of Markandeya Rishi's sincere fixedness, without false ego, the Lord wanted to see him. And then he, in fact, is seeing him. So he's going to describe more about the Lord. O Supreme Personality of Godhead, this is text 41. These two personal forms of yours, Narayan, have appeared to bestow the ultimate benefit for the three worlds, the cessation of material misery and the conquest of death. My Lord, although you create this universe and then assume many transcendental forms to protect it, you also swallow it up, just like a spider who spins and later withdraws its web. So what is he perceiving as the ultimate benefit? He says it right here. The ultimate benefit for the three worlds, you have appeared. And what is that ultimate benefit? There are two things: the cessation of material miseries and the conquest of death. So what one word sums up these two benedictions that the Lord can offer the living entities in the three worlds? Murti ime bhagavato bhagavan triloke chaimaya tapaviramaya chamrityu jityai. So what word sums this up? Well, if not ultimate liberation, it's at least liberation. That tendency is so strong. What tendency? The tendency to want freedom from all material miseries. But of course, and then ultimately, because janma mrityu, jara vyadi, that these are so much in part of material existence. That there's such a tendency, because the material world is such a place, and it's so disturbing. And it is us who tends to want to control the material world. And when we want to be the control of the material world, that the tendency in some form or another to enjoy the material world must be there. Even if it's a small percentage we want, we will get something out of it. Rather than wanting to get free from the material world, or even, because the material world ultimately means death, which is the ultimate misery, rather something else is required, even more than what Markandeya Rishi is desiring, and that is just simply to be an insignificant, humble servant of Krishna, which means serving, it will end up meaning serving everyone, which is a very large task if you think about it, to serve everyone. And of course we can't serve everyone, especially at once. We have to know what our particular service is, and just do that service and keep our consciousness focused on this fact that I am a servant and this is my service. So he's come. Markandeya Rishi is appreciating that the Lord is the controller, he's the creator, he's the destroyer, he's the maintainer of everything. Now this is the kind of Lord that we want to surrender to and serve. Because, as Prabhupada said in that lecture that I'm fond of quoting, that if we understand the purpose of hearing all these literatures is to understand that Krishna is the supreme powerful. He's all powerful. And also, as the first verse said, he's all merciful. It implied that he's all merciful. And then, understanding this about the Lord, then we can we gain in our capacity to surrender to him, to place ourselves under his protection. Go to Devaranam Tata. Unless he's all merciful and unless he's all powerful, he is incomplete, and therefore not be able to provide the protection that a fully surrendered servant requires. So this is Krishna, Markandeya Rishi, who's so deep in his understanding of who the Lord is, because he's perfected his consciousness, because our consciousness will determine what we see and therefore what we don't see as well. Now he's not able to see the form of Krishna in Braja because he doesn't have that kind of consciousness. But he's able to see this and understand fully. His consciousness allows him to see and understand and perceive the Lord as so powerful, the creator of everything. He is the one who maintains everything. He is the one who destroys everything. Everything is wound up into him. Just like a spider winds up the web that he has just created, and he spends a lot of time maintaining as well, if you've ever studied the spiderology. He creates it, By his potency, he maintains it and he destroys it, winds it up back in himself. So Krishna takes the entirety of existence and does that. Now he is the Supreme Lord, and he is the one who can remove all miseries. He is the one who can remove even the shackles of birth and death. So we've summed up the second prayer as, you award the cessation of misery and conquest of death. You create, maintain, and destroy the universe. That's what the verse said. But he goes on, my dear Lord, so he's describing Krishna's power. My dear Lord, even Lord Brahma, who enjoys his exalted position for the entire duration of the universe, fears the passage of time. Because whatever we've created in this realm of materiality, the temporary realm within the universe of the material world, it's going to be destroyed. Even Lord Brahma himself, even though the amount of time he exists is indeterminable, practically we cannot conceive of it. We can take out our calculators or whatever, and we can figure out the length of time and years and earth years of Lord Brahma. But we cannot actually conceive it. What is it? 311 trillion years times this times that is a day of Brahma. But we cannot actually conceive that extent of the passage of time. We cannot conceive of what 1,000 years is like, or 2,000 years. What to speak of 311 trillion million years? It just becomes so many zeros after 311. We can't conceive of what that time span actually is. But later in the next chapter, we're going to get a glimpse in a very unique way of Sutta Goswami's description of Markandeya Rishi's passage of the time of a night of Brahma. And it's if you enter into the description a little, it's quite amazing. It's quite, what's a better word than amazing? Contemporary word is awesome. But that word, because everyone uses it, the weather today was awesome. You know, so it's lost its meaning. But it's amazing. It's amazing. Anyway, we'll hear it tomorrow. But he even fears the passage of time, because it means the end of his existence. That means he's taking shelter of something not worthy of giving him shelter. Then what to speak of those who Brahma creates, the conditioned souls? He doesn't create the souls exactly, but he creates the material circumstance the souls are in. They encounter fearful dangers at every step of their lives. So this is the annihilation principle, the constant annihilation principle. What was that? Nitya annihilation. And better than nitya annihilation, we're tired of nitya annihilation, our circumstances. So then we go to naimittic annihilation, only occasionally, like Brahma. So what a relief occasional annihilation is, so that you have something to worry about. That's what Brahma's situation is. The nitya annihilations, you don't worry about them because they're continuously happening. So the conditioned souls encounter fearful dangers at every step of their lives. And he says, I do not know any relief from this fear except shelter at your lotus feet, which are the very form of liberation. Samasvitamye parapalava plavam mahatpadam punyaya shomarari bhavam buddhiya vatsapadam parampadam parampadam vipara natesham. So Krishna's feet, or shelter, or Krishna's shelter, causes the ocean, the insurmountable ocean of material existence, to shrink to the size of vatsapadam, a calf's footprint, which anyone can easily step over. And he says, this is the conclusion of this rishi, who is perfect, practically speaking, in his mental control. He's perfect in his realization that he's not his body. Why? If for no other reason, first of all, he's withdrawn his consciousness from the body, and even he stopped his mind, his subtle body, from working. So he's aware of himself as consciousness, separate from the material body. And he's also realized by his pratyaksha, his direct experience, if he's lived that long, and he's the only one who's lived that long, that means he's watched everyone else die. So he's realized the very nature of the material world. And this is what his conclusion is in the 43rd verse. I do not know any relief. Four different kinds of annihilations. I do not know any relief from this fear, the fear that Brahma, who has an indeterminable lifespan, that he experiences. There is no relief from the ending of one's life except shelter at your lotus feet, which are the very form there, the substance of liberation. And if one gains the shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna, then one has gained the substance of freedom. Liberation is a prisoner's concept of what the best thing is to be out of prison, to be liberated. But if one gains the lotus feet of the Lord, one has gained the substance, the essence of liberation. And because the Lord is Mukti Pada, he is the shelter of even liberation. So automatically one gains liberation, because he's the tenth principle, the Ashraya principle. So here, remember again the words of Sutta Goswami, why he was happy to hear this last question. They wanted him to speak more. The sages, Shonaka, wanted him to speak more, and he was happy by the question of describing Markandeya Rishi, because it's going to bring topics about Lord Narayan, which is going to purify the soul, and purify again means removing the tendency to think of oneself as central in this world. To removing the tendency to want to exploit material existence. To remove the Kali Yuga tendency for the mind to be always disturbed. Because that is Manda Sumanda. It removes the unluckiness, the misfortune of Kali Yuga. Manda Sumanda Sumatayo Manda Abhagya Upadrutaha. And the disturbance of the mind, if we can get actually, substantially, not theoretically, but actually, practically, learn the art of what he is saying here. There is no other safety and shelter other than the feet of the Lord. So it's a very powerful point. He's already been tested one time in this chapter. But in the next chapter, we're going to hear of another test that he's going to get that makes his previous test of being tested by Indra to be practically speaking like nothing. But he's going to be tested by the Lord himself in the form of his illusory energy. And what makes a test really hard, more difficult than any other element of a test, just goes on and on and on and on and on and on, and the difficulty and the suffering goes on and on and on, because the tendency is we're in a difficult situation. Okay, I'm supposed to chant Hare Krishna, so I say, okay, Hare Krishna. Well, what's going on? The problem is still here. So when a test, a difficult circumstance, goes on and on and on and on, whether we've actually taken shelter of Krishna or we're using Krishna as a technique for liberation, that will be tested. Because using Krishna for liberation is what?
Business,
yes. It's not the word I was thinking of, but it describes it. It's deceitful, dishonest. It's not useless, you get liberation. But yeah, it's basically impersonalism too, to use the deity. There's using Krishna for using the Shalagram Shila to crack nuts, and there's using the Shalagram Shila to step over so you can get liberation. But this isn't bhakti. Jnana kama anavrita anukulena Krishna anushilanam. That serving Krishna and just because he's the kindest, most wonderful Lord, because of love, because of affection, because of the taste, the attachment, the attraction that brings. That's Krishna consciousness, and that's the way to the Goloka Vrindavan that Mahaprabhu and Srila Prabhupada and the followers of Mahaprabhu and the followers of Srila Prabhupada teaching. And Yabilasita Sanyam, this is the essence, this is the Abhideya Tattva. This is the process of gaining prema. Is anyabhilasita sanyam. So we've summarized that verse. Brahma and those created by him, which is us, fear time and the danger they encounter in life. Only shelter at the Lord's feet offers relief from these fears. Do you believe that? Well, today we're all, and every day we're all tested to see where we go for shelter when something happens the way we don't want it to happen, occurs. Therefore, this text 44. Therefore, Markandeya says, I worship your lotus feet. Having renounced my identification with the material body and everything else that covers my true self. So he's realized in that way. But why is that important to get free from the bodily concept of life? Why is it important in taking shelter of Krishna? Well,
the material body means forgetfulness of Krishna.
Well, identification with the material body does. And also, if you want to worship Krishna, if you're thinking of yourself as the material body, then, or attached to the material body, one thing is you're going to become very disappointed if you think this is you, because the material body is going to crumble. It's going to be destroyed. So there is something. So right now the Atma is, we are, you know, the body, the mind, the soul. We have all these mixed up when we think about ourselves. But one of those will survive only, and that is who I actually am. So if I'm thinking of my attached to the body, then I'm going to be thinking that my worship is not working. If I'm attached to the mind, we'll think that Krishna is not going to give me shelter. Is not giving me shelter because I'm not getting exact. My mind isn't just what I want it to be, and my body is crumbling. It's getting old. It is old, in fact. It's not even getting old anymore. So there has to be a detachment from the body, from the false self. And there has to be a giving of the self to Krishna, of who the self actually is. That I am yours, and that means a non-retracting it too, and not taking it back when the mind doesn't feel like it, when the mind is in a bad mood, or the mind is dissatisfied in one of its billion ways. It means something much deeper. At least the platform of nishta, of fixedness, the conviction, the depth of realization has to be on that level. And then true bhajan begins, true worship begins. Tadvai bhajami ritadiyas tavapadamulam. Then worshipping the soles of your lotus feet is real worship. So he's renouncing everything, all these identifications, not caring about them. These useless, insubstantial, and temporary coverings are merely presumed to be separate from you. And what we're going to see is here's his depth of realization. This is what he's realized again. And is he going to be able to live on that platform? That's what we'll hear about in the next chapter. These are presumed to be separate from you, whose intelligence encompasses all truth. By attaining you, the Supreme Godhead and the Master of the Soul, one attains everything desirable. And that's what Sakapriya Mataji said, that these bodies and the mind, they're ignorance in the sense, they are maya in the sense that they give us the experience, the maya experience of being separate from Krishna, which is impossible. Because Krishna is the absolute truth. And we've heard just before the realization that he's seeing Krishna's energy pervading all things and him being the source of all things. But what does this body and mind under the control of maya do? It gives us a very clear and definite sense of being separate from Krishna, and that the body has nothing to do with Krishna. Rather, the body and mind have something to do with me, and the body and mind are meant for me and my pleasure. This is maya. So he's saying, I've had enough. I've realized my realization is so deep. I see this isn't true. But rather, I see that you, the depth of intelligence, with my depth of intelligence that I've gained through the mode of goodness, by practicing, doing my practices, my sadhanas, which are so completely in the mode of goodness. He's done the same thing for day after day after day after day after day after day after day for millions of years. He did the sacrificial fire, he said the mantras on the right time, he did this, he did that. No passion, no ignorance. So therefore, his consciousness is so clear, he sees everything as it is, actually. And this is what he sees. That nothing is separate from you. These coverings over me, they are not separate from you either. They are not me, nor are they separate from you, nor is the tendency that maya gives me to see everything is separate from you, including myself. This has all been shattered by my realizations. And my realization is by attaining you, the Supreme Godhead and the Master of the Soul, one attains everything desirable. Because what do we use our mind to do? What do we use our body to do? What is the driving force behind these things in the world of maya? To get what we desire. It's very simple. Whether we're a monkey or a cow or a mosquito, the mind and body are used to fulfill the desires born of the karma of that living entity. But he's saying, these coverings are just coverings, and I see that it is you. By attaining you, I'll have all my desires. Do we believe that? Well, the tests will come every day. And the test assessment is primarily meant for the student, so he can judge how well he has mastered the topic. He continues, so we've summarized that one. The Rishi renounces his identification with his body and all else that covers the self, noting the ultimate connection of everything in existence to the Lord. All that is desirable is attained by attaining the Lord. So we usually think, what desirable things do we want from our body and our mind? So usually we want a healthy, beautiful body and a mind that's at least peaceful and satisfied and does what we want. So just see how disappointed we're going to be in time, because the mind is always disturbed. This is Kali Yuga, and the body is doomed. If that's what we want, we're in for difficulty. But when we actually gain the shelter of Krishna, then we gain everything desirable. These are actually heavy points. At least I'm finding them so as I'm preaching to myself. O my Lord, O supreme friend of the conditioned soul, although for the creation, maintenance, and annihilation of this world, you accept the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance, which constitute your illusory potency, you specifically employ the mode of goodness to liberate the conditioned souls. What chapter of the Bhagavad Gita speaks on this topic?
14.
And? One should take...
17.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. 17. Because the mode of goodness, things in the mode of goodness, that a devotee keeps himself basically in the mode of goodness, and he makes his offering of the mode of goodness to the Lord. And then that's the basic general principle of the mode of Krishna consciousness. 17th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And also, that was the first question I asked Prabhupada myself. It's 22nd Avenue. Just after His Holiness Jaya Dvaita Maharaj took initiation, Prabhupada was talking about Prahlad, and he said that devotees are in the mode of goodness. And because I had already been chanting for 2 months, and I already figured I knew everything already, so I said, I raised my hand, and Prabhupada called on me, and I said, I thought that you said that devotees are in the mode of goodness. I thought that the devotees were transcendental to the modes, not having any idea of any of it, what transcendental meant, the mode of goodness, especially what the mode of goodness meant. Quite experienced in the mode of passion and ignorance, though. And Prabhupada just answered in a simple way. He said, yes, devotees are transcendental, but generally they act in the mode of goodness. So generally the devotees act in the mode of goodness. Generally, devotees are supposed to act in the mode of goodness. That means that generally the devotees are not supposed to act in the modes of passion and ignorance, or they're never, because they're too dangerous to play with. They are dangerous modes to play with. The mode of goodness is dangerous in a different way, that it conditions one to happiness, peacefulness, and satisfaction. Qualities that most residents of Kali Yuga don't have to worry about getting rid of, because a devotee will do anything for Krishna's pleasure because he is a devotee. That's what it means to be a devotee. His attachment is for the pleasure of Krishna. But generally, the devotee acts in the mode of goodness, and that's the point here, because it is the jumping off platform to the spiritual platform, the Shuddha Sattva platform. Your illusory potency, he continues, or the goodness, passion, and ignorance comprises your illusory potency. You specifically employ the mode of goodness to liberate the conditioned souls. The other two modes simply bring them suffering, illusion, and fear. So So we've summarized that by, the Lord accepts goodness, passion, ignorance within this world. Goodness is useful for liberation, while the other two modes cause suffering, illusion, and fear. So the basic lifestyle of a devotee is meant to cultivate the mode of goodness. The basic lifestyle, and things of the mode of goodness are offered to Krishna for him to eat, and then they become prasadam. 46. O Lord, because fearlessness, spiritual happiness, and the kingdom of God are all achieved through the mode of pure goodness, fearlessness, spiritual happiness, and the kingdom of God. What nice achievements. Fearlessness, because this material world means fearlessness. Fearfulness. Bhayam dvitiya vinaveshita syarishad epatasya viparyato smriti. Fearfulness means we see things inaccurately. We see things separate from Krishna. So fearlessness is achieved. Spiritual happiness, that means contact with spirits, with Krishna's service, and the kingdom of God, when one is fully developed in his devotional service, are all achieved through the mode of pure goodness, the internal energy of Krishna. Your devotee considers this mode, but never passion and ignorance, to be a direct manifestation of you, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Intelligent persons wishing to deal with the mode of pure goodness, therefore worship your beloved transcendental form composed of pure goodness along with the spiritual forms of your pure devotees. And so many Golokera Premadana Harinama Sankirtana. The form of the holy name is not of the material world. Devotional service itself is not of the material world. The Dham, the land of Vrindavan, is not of the material world. The Srimad Bhagavatam is not of the material world. And pointing out also the association with the Sadhusanga, the pure devotees, this is not of the material world. And this was actually the experience of being with Srila Prabhupada, even though the devotees perhaps were immature. And but the experience of being with him was like being with a person from a different realm. Yeah, there was the transcendental sweetness of Vrindavan there, but even though we couldn't recognize it, perhaps, but he was clearly not of this world. His, you know, when you see a, like Prabhupada, when he saw how the devotees painted like pictures of Krishna with an effulgence around his head, he said that it's not actually correct that God only has an effulgence around his head. You know, that saintly persons and the Lord, they are effulgent from every part of their existence, their bodies. In common contemporary New Agey type of people, they talk about the auras and things like that. But yes, it's true. There was this time I was walking with Bhakti Vigyanaraj at the Kremlin. The one time I did that, and we were walking one way, and we were in Dodi's. And we were walking, there were about five of us, and then some people walked the other way, the opposite. And it was terrifying. I mean, nothing about them, but it was terrifying. Their vibration was it caused terror to enter my heart. Not that it can happen in New York, but or other places. But people have different energies, and the devotees of the Lord, their forms are comparable to the form of the Lord, composed of pure goodness. So intelligent persons, he's saying, take shelter and worship that mode and the things that are composed of that mode, and they keep away from the lesser modes of material nature. And they understand that what will come through association with that mode is fearlessness, spiritual happiness, and the kingdom of God. This is all three of these are the land of bhakti. They're the realm of bhakti, of devotion, of devotional service. So we've summarized that verse. Devotees thus consider goodness as a manifestation of the Lord, and intelligent persons worship your form as it is, as well as the form of your pure devotee. As it is, as well as the form of your pure devotee composed of pure goodness. So very wonderful. So his consciousness is fine due to his purity. So therefore, he's able to clearly perceive the differences between these kind of manifestations of the Lord. So one could say that everything is coming from Krishna, so therefore everything is the same, therefore I can do anything or associate with anything. But his consciousness, so a person whose consciousness is fine, is tuned out of the mode of good passion and the mode of ignorance, and even out of the mode of goodness, he can perceive very clearly the difference between the manifestation of these different modes. And like attracts like, so he completely naturally is attracted and attached to the purity, because his consciousness is sudha-sattva. He's naturally attracted to things like that. Otherwise, one cannot approach it with impure consciousness. One cannot approach the spiritual realm unless one has that type of consciousness. So therefore, fearlessness is a product of spiritual consciousness, and it's not possible to get free from fear without spiritual consciousness. And spiritual happiness is a product of spiritual consciousness, obviously, and what to speak of the kingdom of God. So they're all the same element. They're all composed of sudha-sattva. Then, and therefore, he's in front of the Lord, and he's perceiving the nature of the Lord, his spiritual energy. Remember, what was his effulgence compared to be? Yeah, so he's effulgent. So, and Markandeya Rishi, his hands are folded in supplication, and his head is bowed, because he's in front of the source of all in existence, and he is able to speak. He has that consciousness, and by his purity we're able to hear what he's perceiving. And of course, it's different from what the residents of Vrindavan perceive. But yet, it is so exalted. It is so exalted. When the residents of Vrindavan see Lord Narayan at Peta, they say, "Excuse me, could you tell us where Krishna is?" They offer their obeisances very respectfully, but we were looking for Krishna. So their consciousness is different again, but we can't perceive of that type of exalted love. So now he just offers his obeisances in 47. "I offer my humble obeisances to him, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is the all-pervading and all-inclusive form of the universe." So think of what that means. He's all-pervading, all-inclusive. So this is the consciousness of someone who has gone the path that he's gone through. He's all-pervading and all-inclusive. He's the all-inclusive form of the universe. The universe is all included within him. So he's actually going to have, in the next chapter, he's actually going to have that experience. How everything in existence is included within the Lord. He's going to actually have that physical experience. And because he also exists, he's also going to find out what it's like to be within the Lord. So the things that he's talking about, he's going to experience. I bow down, he continues his prayers, his obeisances. He is the all-pervading, all-inclusive form of the universe, as well as its spiritual master. I bow down to Lord Narayan, the supreme worshipable deity, appearing as a sage, and also to the saintly Nara, the best of human beings, who is fixed in perfect goodness, fully in control of his speech, and the propagator of the Vedic literatures, to elevate the consciousness of the conditioned souls so that they can perceive something of what Markandeya Rishi is perceiving in all great souls. Because this point has been made many times, that Vedes Chasavara Meva Vidyo, it's just been recently made also, that it is Krishna, that the Vedas, we just heard 1.5 chapters on how the Vedas come from the Lord, and then all the Puranic literatures come, and then here it is, the entirety of it is Srimad Bhagavatam, summed up, the entirety of this vast ocean of Vedic literatures, Puranic literatures, and all the Vedas. And it's all Srimad Bhagavatam. It's all there in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam is Krishna, who is the source of everything. So he is the propagator of the Vedic literatures. And his potency, he's also the spiritual master in that sense. That's, his mercy comes in that way. Then 48. A materialist, his intelligence perverted by the actions of his deceptive senses, cannot recognize you at all. So what is it that makes a materialist? What does it make a person a materialist? Huh? So what is it causes that his senses to be deceptive? Huh? Yes.
Ignorance.
Yes. Yes. He's thinking.
Thinking that matter is primary.
Primary? In what sense primary?
First there is matter, and then there is consciousness.
Okay, yes, so that's... a materialist... Actually, the term came from a German philosopher who said, I'm proud to be known as a materialist. I remember this from a university named Feuerbach. And he said, it means I believe what I can see. That is what I believe. So the whole scientific principle is based on this. On perception and expanded perception through scientific methodology. But the consciousness of a materialist is a conditioned soul. It means that he has false ego. And therefore that consciousness colors what he sees. And he sees the material world as its existence is for my exploitation. So whether the conditioned soul, the materialist, is within the body of a human being or an animal or an insect or a bird, tiger, lion, there's the common element that his consciousness perceives himself as the center, and then when he sees with his eyes, hears with his ears, his senses are covered by this consciousness, and he cannot recognize you at all. He's speaking to Narayan Rishi. Although you are always present within his own senses and heart, and also among the objects of his perception. So this was the going back practically to his first prayer, that you are the one whose your energy has entered into me and given me the ability to speak. I won't be able to glorify you completely because you're the energy that's beyond my capacity, the energetic. So he's saying that a materialist cannot recognize you who is giving his senses the energy to perceive, and also you're the objects that he's perceiving. It's you, because you are the absolute truth. There's nothing external to you. There's nothing separate from you. You are always present. So you are there. You are there right in front of him at every second, at every moment. Anta bihir vastitam, Kunti Devi says. You are always present. You are there at every moment. But he cannot see you at any moment. Yet even though one's understandings has been covered by your illusory potency, if one obtains Vedic knowledge from you, the Supreme Spiritual Master of all, he can directly understand you. So a very wonderful verse, because it explains that the condition of a materialist. So who is a materialist? Who are the materialists he's talking about? Those rascal scientists, or is it us who have little bits of false ego maybe left? So a materialist, so here he can't perceive Krishna, he's saying. So what hope is there? Because if you can't see, you can't see. What hope is there for you to see Krishna? So what's the answer here? Krishna is there everywhere, but you can't see him. But even though one's understanding about Krishna's position has been covered by the illusory potency, if one obtains Vedic knowledge from you, because you are the source, and what is the ripened fruit of all the Vedic knowledge is Srimad Bhagavatam. So if one obtains Vedic knowledge from you, who is the supreme spiritual master of all, he can directly understand you, getting light. The darkness of materialistic vision, which is ignorance, and always sees contaminated by that, we see improperly, by the light of Vedic knowledge, by the light of the Bhagavatam, by the light of the gift that we've been given by Srila Prabhupada in his translating this, by the light given by the acharyas, by the light of Sukadev, by the light of Sutta, by the light of Maitreya Muni, then we who are blind can see and can directly understand you, can perceive things accurately as they are. That is some meaning from that sloka. Very important sloka. We summarized it. Although always present, you are beyond the perception and beyond perception and unrecognizable to a materialist. Gaining Vedic knowledge from you can cause anyone to directly perceive you. So remember, this is coming right at the close of the Bhagavatam. So again, the conclusion is really about the Bhagavatam here. And then he ends his prayer saying, my dear Lord, the Vedic literature alone reveal confidential knowledge of your Supreme Personality, and thus even such great scholars as Lord Brahma himself are bewildered in their attempt to understand you through empirical methods, through ascending methods, through their own power. But the Vedic literatures reveal you. They give light. They take away darkness. So therefore, it's so clear why Prabhupada emphasized the translating, the publishing, the distribution, and the studying of, and hearing and studying and speaking these Vedic literatures, the Bhagavatam. Because without this knowledge coming directly from Krishna, this light, this instruction coming directly from Krishna. And it comes in three different parts, as analyzed by Mahaprabhu and his followers: Sambandha Gyan, Avideya, and Prayojana. The knowledge of our relationship with Krishna, who Krishna is and what our relationship with him is. What is the material world? What is time? What is karma? And then what is the process, the Abhideya Tattva, what is the process of changing, transforming the consciousness from being a conditioned soul to, in ignorance, to being an enlightened soul? And then finally, what or who and where that goal is, the prayojana, where does it all lead? So this is what the Bhagavatam is about. Even great scholars, as Lord Brahma himself, are bewildered in their attempt to understand you through empiric methods. So without Shastra, even the most intelligent cannot understand. Each philosopher understands you according to his particular speculative conclusions. Again, this has been mentioned before in the 11th canto, I think in two places. Krishna tells Uddhava that we see and explain, understand and explain according to our consciousness. We don't see reality. We see according to our consciousness. Just like a fly has a compound eye and he can perceive movement, but not direct form, perhaps. And a mosquito perceives only heat, and therefore he comes to the arm or wherever to suck. He can perceive the life, the blood. And that's what he sees. He sees, he doesn't call it blood, but that's what he perceives. So everyone perceives according to their body and their consciousness. So even the most intelligent Lord Brahma and the ones who are below him, the different sages and rishis and philosophers, they don't perceive accurately. They perceive according to their consciousness, their own consciousness, which has some contaminations of the modes of passion, ignorance, and even goodness. But when Krishna himself, the one who perceives all of reality, tells you it is like this, then when one adopts his knowledge and his methodology and his goal that he's saying, then he can perceive things on an equal level to Krishna even. So therefore he says, "My dear Lord, your Vedic literatures alone reveal confidential knowledge of your Supreme Personality. Otherwise, how will we know Krishna unless he tells us?" So therefore, the purpose of all this, that explanation of the Puranic literature, is to show the position of the Bhagavatam and how it's Nigama Kalpaturu Galatam Phalam, that this is what it is. And this is the only way that one can actually perceive the personality who is the absolute truth, Krishna. And thus even such great scholars as Lord Brahma himself are bewildered in their attempt to understand you through empirical ascending methodology. Each philosopher understands you according to his particular speculative conclusions. What does that mean? Each scholar understands you according to his particular speculative conclusions.
It's only a relative projection.
A projection. In other words, Atmavan Manyate Jagat, he's only seeing what he thinks, his own conclusion, and that's what he sees. So what is he? So all we end up seeing is our own minds. What do you think about that? It's such a heavy point, actually. When we see that the world is bad, and this person's like this, and this person's like that, all we're seeing is our own mind. And because it's true, when you're in a good mood, the world suddenly is nicer. But the world doesn't change, it's just our rascal mind has flipped. So each, what to speak of ordinary people, even philosophers who are exalted in their intelligence, born of the mode of goodness, and intelligence also passion, they only see the speculative, they only understand reality, the supreme reality, Krishna, according to their speculative conclusions. And he concludes his prayers, in the 49th verse, by saying, I worship that supreme person, knowledge of whom is hidden by the bodily designations covering the conditioned soul's spiritual identity. It's our bodily identifications. That means both the gross and subtle bodily identifications. They hide our own identity due to the misidentification with the body and the mind, and therefore they pollute our consciousness, and therefore we cannot understand Krishna. Anyway, I'll just read my summary to that and then we'll read the purport. Vedic knowledge reveals you, who is otherwise ununderstandable. What do you think about that? That otherwise, unless we hear from Shastra, that Krishna is ununderstandable. What do you think about that?
So wonderful. We are here reading Bhagavatam.
Yeah, that's one nice thought. Yes.
Otherwise, there's no way.
Yeah, and it means that also one has to have faith in Shastra. Otherwise, we don't have any other access to Krishna specifically. Therefore, it's so important that we learn Shastra, we hear Shastra, then we speak from Shastra. And if we speak from our minds, then it will be limited by the capacity of our mind, and whatever capacity our mind is, it's limited compared to the unlimited Krishna. And therefore, he says, his conclusion is, I therefore simply worship you. I worship that supreme person, knowledge of whom is hidden by the bodily designations covering the conditioned soul's spiritual identity. Purport. Even great demigods like Brahma are bewildered in their speculative attempts to understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Each philosopher is covered by a unique combination of the modes of nature, and thus describes the supreme truth according to his own material conditioning. Therefore, even strenuous empirical endeavor will never bring one to the conclusion of all knowledge. The highest knowledge is Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and one can understand him only by one can understand him only by fully surrendering to him and serving him with love, because then by his mercy he reveals himself. This is why Markandeya Rishi states here, Vandeya Mahapurusham, I simply worship that Supreme Personality. Those who try to worship God but at the same time continue speculating or acting fruitively will attain only mixed and bewildering results. So therefore, the Abhideya Tattva is Anya Bilasita Sanyam Jnanakama Anavrita Anukulena Krishna Nashilanam Bhakti Uttamaya. It is performing pure devotional service. In that way, to be a pure devotee, a devotee must give up all fruit of activity and mental speculation, and that way his loving service to the Lord will yield perfect knowledge of the Supreme. Only this perfection can satisfy the eternal soul. Thus, in the purports of the humble servants of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, to the 12th canto, 8th chapter, of the Srimad Bhagavatam entitled Mokindeya's Prayers to Naranarayan Rishi. Okay, thank you very much. So there's two more chapters in this pastime of Mokindeya Rishi. He's going to get quite a surprise very soon. And then there's one more chapter describing the Mahapurusha, because here he's called Vande Mahapurusha. So the Mahapurusha is being described here. That's the conclusion of Mokindeya Rishi to worship. I worship the Mahapurusha. And then the 11th chapter is a description of the Mahapurusha from a particular point of view. And then description of the Bhagavatam summarized and glorified. And then the closing chapter. This is only 13 verses or so. No, 20. 22, 3 verses. Okay. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Mokindeya Rishi ki jai, Sri Naranarayan Rishi ki jai. Thank you. Any prayers to offer to the Supreme Lord? Or any comments or questions?
You mentioned that there are some surprising things that are in the next chapters, and you were not sure whether you were going to speak about them. So would you kindly allude to some of that?
I think I should accede to Narayani Mataji giving those classes, and at the end when I give the next class, I'll talk about them a little, maybe. I mean, what I saw was amazing. Well, just, it was basically the description of the waters of dissolution and what indeterminable time is. It's
indeterminable time.
It's just... I found it quite amazing, that chapter. It was very... I was a bit even shocked by it. What he wanted and what the Lord reciprocated with him. But I'll probably end up speaking about it a little bit after the beginning of the class on the 11th chapter.
Since this story deals with the same topic, the whole canto is said to be dealing with Nirodha by Shishmat, or dissolution, or death, dying. It seems to be dealing with the topic of dying from this other perspective. We have a person who is not dying, and we can see whether it's we want. Because Pariksit died, and here we have another person.
Well, I have a... This is one of the things I would like to talk about on the... The canto really has a wonderful continuity to it. But I would say it's more about shelter than dying.
Yeah. And the conclusion that the real blessing he needed was that Gopal lying on the banyan.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yes, I agree. Any other questions or comments, Mataji?
A comment. I really appreciated the way Purport hit the nail on the head here. Number 44 is Purport. One falsely identifies himself as the material body or mind, automatically feels entitled to exploit the material world. I thought that was very well put.
Yeah. Why does he feel entitled?
Because I'm the center.
Why does he think of himself the center?
Because he's completely separated from Krishna.
But why does he feel separated from Krishna?
Because he thinks he can do it on his own.
But why does he think he can do it on his own?
Because he's identifying with the false ego.
And why is he identifying with the false ego?
Because he desired to turn his face away from Krishna.
All these are necessary but insufficient. Why?
Because he
Why is he having all this experience?
He wants to enjoy.
Huh?
He wants to enjoy.
Yes. Why does he want to enjoy? What's giving him that? It's not his nature. It's not natural. He's a soul.
He rejects that he's a servant.
And therefore, he is placed under the control of Maya. He's in illusion. He's captivated by Krishna's illusory energy. He's completely under the... He wants to be the master, but he ends up being a servant of Maya. And Maya is forcing all these things upon him. The identification with the body, identification with the mind, pushing him by the modes of ignorance, passion, and goodness. Pushing him, whipping him with thirst, with hunger, with this desire, with that desire. Can't be happy. Beating him. And this is Maya's reaction to his desire to compete with the Lord. And everything goes upside down. His rejection of his servitude to Krishna. So he feels entitled. How to read that sentence again, Parvati Mataji?
By identifying himself as the material body or mind, one feels automatically entitled to exploit the material world.
So this is Maya's work. This is all Maya's illusions work. And it's powerful. Maya is powerful. Because we are weak in our desire to serve. Good point. Any other questions or comments?
Narayana Rishi is spoken of as one person, but whereas there are two. Why is it like this?
Because he's called Narayana Rishi when talking about one, but Narayana is the two of them.
We always say Narayana Rishi, but Narayana Rishi is...
Good. Sanskrit grammatical question. Why is it Narayana Rishi instead of Rishis? That's the question. Because there's...
They're always together. And
in Sanskrit, is Rishi plural?
In Sanskrit, it's dual.
Dual.
Which is present only in two languages, Lithuanian and Slovenian. So therefore, every other language, you have to choose either singular or...
And Sanskrit has the dual case.
Sanskrit has the dual case.
Yeah.
How is
and the singular and the dual are the same?
No, different.
So what's...
Rishal. There are two rishis. Rishal is mentioned here.
How about Markandeya?
Rishi.
Rishi, so that's singular.
Singular.
And
Narayana, it says Rishal.
There you go.
Rishal.
Well, now you know why everyone says Rishi. Because they don't want to say Rishal. No, no. You can start fed in ISKCON. Any other questions? Yes.
Goodness is important for liberation. In the 45th shloka, it says about goodness, but in the next shloka, it says...
Wait, slowly.
In the next shloka, it says more than pure goodness. So is the same thing discussed, or is it different?
You mean what the verses are saying?
The verse says that it specifically implores more than goodness to liberate the conditioned souls. Because fearlessness, spiritual happiness.
No, say again so I can hear.
Because fearlessness, spiritual happiness, and kingdom of God are all achieved through the mode of pure goodness. You're able to consider
ultimately. Them. Ultimately. So some of they put in the translation some of the comment that pure goodness is different from the mode of goodness. And the mode of goodness gives knowledge, which gives liberation. But the mode of pure goodness is still above that, because there is no pure goodness in this world. But they put some commentary in the translation. No. I'm saying the translation making a distinction between pure goodness and goodness, for goodness can give liberation. Pure goodness gives is bhakti, it's the land of bhakti. So it's not clear in the verse itself, but in the commentaries it's clarified. So they've made, I mean, the Sanskrit verse itself. So they've made, as Prabhupada often does too, made the verse reflect the commentaries of the acharyas. You follow what I mean?
Yes.
Let me just. What verse are we talking about?
14, 15, and 46.
So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, therefore, the wise give up the impure forms of Indra and others made of Maya. This is his commentary on the on the 46th verse. The wise give up the impure forms of Indra and others made of Maya and worship the Shuddha Sattva form of the Lord and his devotees. Devotees like Narada recognize the form of Vishnu, which is Sattva. What type of Sattva is this? From this Lord arises Vaikuntha with no fear of falling, the fear of falling of Swarga, because there's no fear of falling, there is spiritual happiness, not happiness from results of karma. Therefore, it is Suddha Sattva, not material Sattva. So that was the comment of Vishwanath that I didn't neglected to read. So what I'm saying that he's made the point clear in the translation, and he's by taking the point from the commentary that makes the points clear and put it into the translation.
The distinction could be seen when Sattva becomes pure.
It has no contaminations of the lower modes of nature, because the Sattva in this world is never completely pure. It's a different energy. It's a different energy, Suddha Sattva. It's a spiritual energy. Pure goodness, Suddha Sattva, is a spiritual energy, while Sattva Guna of this world is a material energy, and it's always contaminated to one degree or another. Suddha Sattva is a spiritual energy. It is what it's composed of, the spiritual energy. It's not like you can do something to the material energy. And make it Suddha Sattva. It's a different energy. It's eternal.
Regarding this Naranarayana, actually it's Naranarayanao Rishi, Lord who we attend. Mm-hmm. So duo is not Rishav. Rishav means in the two rishis, but two rishis in nominative case would be Rishi.
But with the long.
Yeah.
As opposed to one Rishi being
Rishi
as opposed to Rishi.
Well, the emphasis can still be on the first syllable, but the second E is long.
Yes.
Rishi and Rishi.
Okay. Let's end, because it's exactly 2:00. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srila Prabhupada bhakti vrinda.